curious beast with its enormous moonlit smile.
The piano season on BBC Radio 3 continues with a special edition of Words and Music. Love, loss, nostalgia, determination and joy, all inspired by the piano.
I regret that before people can be reformed, they have to be sinners. And that before you have pianists in the family, you have to have beginners.
Words by Ogden Nash, D.H. Lawrence, William Shakespeare and Jane Austen, and music that is just as transporting. Words and Music, tomorrow night at 6:30.
BBC Radio 3, 90 to 93 FM on digital radio and online. Just gone 1 o'clock, time for the news from Ian Skelly.
The Department of Health is to investigate the decision to appoint Jimmy Savile to lead a task force overseeing the management of Broadmoor Hospital after the board was dismissed in 1988. Police investigating allegations that the star abused numerous young girls over several decades say they are following more than 300 lines of inquiry. Royal Bank of Scotland has begun the task of looking for a new buyer for more than 300 of its branches. The planned buyer, Santander, has pulled out. RBS Group has to offload the branches by the end of next year as part of the deal that secured a government handout when it was in financial difficulties. The UN and Arab League envoy to Syria, Lakhdar Brahimi, is in Turkey for talks. Tensions between Syria and Turkey have been mounting. Syrian shells have been landing across the border. In one incident, 5 Turkish civilians were killed. Turkey's Prime Minister Recep Tayyip Erdogan told an audience in Istanbul today that delays at the UN were putting Syria's future in danger. Egypt's Prosecutor General Abdel Majid Mahmoud has resumed work amid tight security, defying President Mohamed Morsi's orders to stand down. President Morsi tried to sack him after he acquitted more than 40 senior loyalists of the former president Hosni Mubarak, who'd been accused of orchestrating an attack on protesters during last year's uprising. A study has claimed that a third runway at Heathrow would triple the number of early deaths from pollution linked to the airport. The report says that building a new airport in the Thames estuary would lead to far fewer deaths. A lobster that's more than 50 years old and almost a metre long has been saved from the cooking pot. A fish merchant in Devon thought the lobster was too old and too special to be eaten. It'll now spend its retirement in the comfort and safety of Bristol Aquarium. Well, the weather today, it'll be a cloudy day with rain in Scotland. There'll be a mixture of sunshine and showers for the rest of the country, but some of those showers will feel heavy with a risk of thunder. Eastern parts are likely to remain dry. And that's the BBC News and the weather. It's 1:03.
And so now we come to the early music show. And as part of our piano season, Lucy Skeeping presents the first of two programmes on the period piano.
Thank you. the harpsichordist Luciano Sgrizzi playing one of Domenico Scarlatti's keyboard sonatas in B-flat. It is such a distinctive sound, isn't it, the harpsichord, and pretty familiar these days. But in both our programmes this weekend, as part of the BBC piano season, we're going to be exploring the instrument that we perhaps don't hear quite so often on the Early Music Show, the keyboard that developed from the harpsichord, namely the early piano. Of course, the harpsichord and the piano sound very different from each other. It's all about how they're constructed. So who better to give us the lowdown than someone who is intimately acquainted with what goes on inside their wooden casings, the instrument restorer, Kirsten Schwarz. So what's the basic difference between these two keyboard instruments?
The nice thing with a piano action is that you can actually change the sound intensity by pressing the key. You can play more soft or more loud just with the dip of the finger, which in a harpsichord is not possible. The sound intensity, it's always the same.
The period instrument restorer, Kirsten Schwarz, and we'll be hearing more from her later on. First, though, so we can get a clearer idea of how very different these two keyboard instruments sound, let's hear the same sonata that we heard at the beginning of the programme, only this time played on a copy of a very early piano. Domenico Scarlatti's Sonata in B-flat for the second time. Only that performance by Linda Nicholson was on not a harpsichord, but a reconstruction of one of the earliest pianos made in 1730 in the workshop of Bartolomeo Cristofori. And we'll be hearing more about him later. Of course, when it comes to what exactly the early piano could do, well, the clue is in the name. It was called the forte piano, and later the other way round, the piano forte. In other words, the great selling point for this new invention was the fact that it could play both loud, as in forte, and quiet, or piano. So just how do the two instruments differ when it comes to dynamics? Well, being a harpsichordist and a professor of forte piano at Trinity College of Music, Stephen Devine has a foot in both camps.
The harpsichord is the plucked member of the keyboard family. It's got cousins and brothers and sisters, but they all work exactly the same. That is a quill plucking the string. So when you press a harpsichord key down, a jack, which is a piece of fruit wood that's resting on the key, it jumps up, and in that is this piece of bird quill. The bird quill plucks the string, and then the job's done. It doesn't matter how hard you press the key on a harpsichord, the jack will jump up at different speeds, but the quill will always pluck at the same speed. So you have no dynamic variety by playing different strengths with your fingers on a harpsichord. On the piano, you have a hammer action. The hammers are set off by pressing the key, obviously, and depending on the speed you press the key, the hammer will then move at a different velocity and hit the string at a different velocity, so you do end up with tonal variety.
Stephen Devine. So when it comes to the piano, it's all about the hammer action. And the first instrument maker who seems to have had an idea for all this, and therefore I suppose you could say invented the modern piano, was an Italian, Bartolomeo Cristofori. He was certainly in the right place for such a monumental musical development because his life was spent surrounded by keyboards. From 1688, when he was in his early 30s, Cristofori was the curator of instruments at the Medici court in Florence under Prince Ferdinand. Kirsten Schwarz, who's made three modern copies of pianos made by Cristofori, takes up the story.
Cristofori was 33 years old when he moved from Padua to Florence. He was called by Prince Ferdinando himself, and we only can guess that he probably already experimented with a hammer action when he was in Padua, because he must have been already at that time a known instrument maker, otherwise Prince Ferdinando wouldn't have heard from him. No other piano action before Cristofori. At the beginning of the 18th century, there were in all of Europe people experimenting with hammer actions, but he was the first. And it's really incredible how perfect it was by the time of 1720, the year we have the first surviving piano. What Cristofori himself called it, we don't know, but the first document we have from 1700, which is the inventory of Prince Ferdinando's collection of musical instruments, the instrument is called Arpicimbalo di nuova invenzione che fa il piano il forte, which means the new invented harpsichord which plays soft and loud. The second very important document is from 1711, where the instrument is described as gravicembalo col piano e forte, a harpsichord which plays soft and loud. And indeed, by looking at the surviving instruments, it is quite clear that Cristofori's piano was a harpsichord with a hammer action, because the main fundamental construction elements are very similar to the harpsichords of Cristofori which survived of the same period. The Christofori action is a full-functioning hammer action, which actually contains all the fundamental parts of the modern piano. The hammers of the Christofori action are very, very light. They are actually of paper rolls, made of paper, which has been put into glue water. When it's dry, it's very strong, but to the same time, it remains elastic. On top of this paper roll is just a little piece of deer skin, and the diameter is just a centimeter. The musician can actually control very well the playing, and the hammer won't block against the strings. The escapement is very important. It enables the hammer to go down before it hits the string, so it won't block. So the hammer falls down just 1 millimeter before it hits the string. This made it possible to have it possibilities of dynamic without the strings are blocked. Another addition, a very important addition apart from the escapement, is the check, which means the hammer coming back from the string will rest on a little piece of leather, which prevents the hammer of bouncing back to the string. Christofori must have been a genius to reach to this point of perfection. He clearly continued all his life to work on the action and to make it more efficient. The action survived in the piano from 1726, which is just at the very end of his career. It's just a masterpiece. You couldn't make it better.
Kerstin Schwarz talking about Bartolomeo Christofori, the inventor of the piano. Well, as you can imagine, this new instrument, whatever you call it, began to attract the interest of composers. Only gradually at first, mind you. Perhaps it was still a brave composer who would be amongst the first to dip his toe into the water of this new and distinctive sound.
The first published music which was really written for the piano was the sonatas of Ludovico Giustini. The sonatas remain a singular case. They clearly have been inspired by the instrument, and it's very probable that Giustini, of course, knew the instrument. There are indications of piano and forte in the instrument, and you can see also by the very nice and dreamy cantabile style that he definitely knew the instrument.
Thank you. Wolfgang Brunner with the opening movement of Giustini's Sonata No. 1 in G minor. It dates from 1732, and it's thought to have been the first music ever composed for the hammered keyboard instrument, the forte piano, that, because of its unique construction, was able to play both loudly and quietly. Well, we now have an instrument that is a recognisable ancestor of the modern piano. But don't imagine that Cristofori's invention immediately took off and instantly inspired composers to write music for it.
It didn't influence composers directly. The direct influence of the piano is much later. I would say it's only from the sons of Bach in Germany that really the piano influenced the style of composing. At the time of Giustini, which was 1732, this was a quite singular case. And apart from that, composers were still writing for the harpsichord in mind.
Nevertheless, Cristofori did have an influence on other instrument makers.
Cristofori was copied all over Europe. It's very interesting that makers like Silbermann, who very probably experimented themselves with new hammer action, at the end decided that Cristofori's action was so perfect that they just copied it. I just building a copy of a Silbermann piano. It is clearly to see that Silbermann in all details copied Cristofori, and it's indeed quite clear that Cristofori piano must have been in Germany, although there are no documents, so that Silbermann was able to investigate the Cristofori action very closely.
Thank you. J.S. Bach's Prelude and Fugue No. 20 from the Well-Tempered Clavier, performed on a copy of a Silbermann piano. The player there was Robert Levin. So what does he think was the effect of this new technology on the composers of the day?
Bach knew the piano. He knew the Silbermann piano, which was directly modeled after the Cristofori. So he knew what a piano sounded like. Obviously, Haydn and Mozart did. Beethoven did. What these composers are always dealing with is a cutting edge of risk and expression of great intensity tailored to the medium. And I think it's very, very important as we contemplate piano playing to have a constant dialogue with where we come from. They may have battled against certain acoustical properties, but they took advantage of others. And to the extent that we learn these things, I think we become much more universal and more unpredictable and more volatile artists. My own interface with these things has not been designed towards the advocacy of period instruments over modern ones, because I wouldn't give up my beloved Steinway for anything.
Well, that's an unexpected view from such an acclaimed period instrument performer. But what did J.S. Bach think about the Silbermann pianos? Here's Stephen Devine again.
We don't actually have that much information for the early history of the piano, which is quite fascinating because so few instruments survive from that period. What we do know is that Bach came across what were called the new instruments that his son, Carl Philipp Emanuel, was playing in Potsdam. He was a fan of Silbermann. He knew who Silbermann was anyway, because Silbermann made organs as well as harpsichords. He is reported to have liked these instruments very much, but suggested one or two modifications, particularly, I understand, with regard to the evenness of touch. In later years, Bach was criticised for his old-fashionedness, if you like, and it's possible that, of course, what he didn't like was the flexibility and the freedom that these Silbermann instruments gave. Unfortunately, we know very little about the actual instruments that he saw. There are no surviving examples from that period. So if we extrapolate back from instruments we do know, such as a 1785 Heilmann instrument and similar things, they are quite hard to control as regards an instrument of, say, 20 years later, the instruments that Mozart knew in his maturity. So it's possible that his criticisms were very valid.
So let's hear the sound of one of those Silbermann pianos. Well, a faithful replica of one anyway. This is the first movement of a piano concerto by C.P.E. Bach. Thank you. was Miklós Spányi playing a replica of a Silbermann fortepiano from 1749, accompanied there by Concerto Armonico, the first movement of C.P.E. Bach's Concerto in D. You're listening to The Early Music Show with me, Lucy Skeeping, and we're exploring the history of the piano in today's programme. Well, the bright, new, technically sophisticated piano was now making its mark with composers. Mozart began experimenting with it, and he particularly favoured models made by Johann Andreas Stein of Augsburg. Not that this stopped him criticising the playing of Stein's daughter, Nanette, and in characteristically cheeky style.
Instead of sitting in the middle of the clavier, she sits right up opposite the treble, as it gives her more chance of flopping about and making grimaces. She rolls her eyes and smirks. When a passage is repeated, she plays it more slowly the second time. If it has to be played a third time, then she plays it even more slowly. When a passage is being played, the arm must be raised as high as possible, and according as the notes in the passage are stressed, the arm, not the fingers, must do this, and that too with great emphasis in a heavy and clumsy manner. But the best joke of all is that when she comes to a passage which ought to flow like oil and which necessitates a change of finger, she does not bother her head about it. But when the moment arrives, she just leaves out the notes, raises her hand and starts off again quite comfortably.
A little unfair, perhaps, since Nanette was only 8 years old when Mozart wrote those words. In fact, she went on to become a piano maker herself when her father died in 1794. She and her brother Matthias took over the family business. Mozart was now firmly attached to the new style piano, and he stretched its capabilities to the very limit in order to create a really distinctive style of keyboard writing, as Stephen Devine explains.
When he was playing instruments towards the end of his life, in the end of the 1780s, 1790s, a lot of these instruments only had three strings in the extreme treble, and they were generally bichord, that's two strings for each note. This gives you a much sort of more silvery-like sound, particularly towards the sort of upper treble before it becomes three strings. And I think Mozart, being a complete genius and listening to all the sounds and working with what he's hearing, he writes a lot of his most melodic music in the piano sonatas, the late piano sonatas, and in the piano concerti, in that area. And this gives a very silvery, a very gentle but singing tone. And it's also possible to play fairly loudly, whereas when you go higher up these earlier fortepianos, you can't play quite so loud, and you do find it very easy to make a wooden, rather sort of harsh noise as you go higher.
So here's the first movement of Mozart's Piano Concerto No. 13 in C. It's played on a copy of an instrument made around 1785 by Nanette's father, Johann Andreas Stein. The soloist is Robert Levin.
Thank you.
Robert Levin, the soloist there, with the first movement of Mozart's Piano Concerto No. 13, with the Academy of Ancient Music, conducted by Christopher Hogwood. Well, that's almost it for the Early Music Show today, I'm afraid, but I'll be continuing the story of the period piano tomorrow. In particular, the battle in the 18th century between the two major schools of piano making, Vienna and London. Who came out on top and did they deserve to win? Listen tomorrow to find out. Meanwhile, to end today's programme, let's hear some music played on a copy of an instrument made by one of the most popular Viennese makers, Anton Walter, whose pianos were owned by both Mozart and Beethoven. Andreas Steyer plays two minuets from Mozart's sonata in E-flat.
Steyer performing two minuets by Mozart from his sonata in E-flat, KV282. The Early Music Show was presented by Lucy Skeeping and produced in Salford by Nick Holmes. And you can download that programme from the Radio 3 website. Well, at the same time tomorrow, Lucy presents the second programme in her two-part survey of the period piano. And the piano season on the BBC continues with this afternoon's Saturday Classics in an hour's time and Marc-André Hamelin's choice of piano music.
It was a time when legend gave way to history. Half a millennium between the end of Roman rule and the Norman conquest in 1066. The Anglo-Saxons, rediscovered on BBC Radio 3 through a new series of 30 portraits of groundbreaking Anglo-Saxon men and women.
I stood looking at the gold from the Mercian heartland, evoking that glittering half-pagan, half-Christian world of warlords, warriors and bards.
With speakers including Michael Wood, Seamus Heaney and the Archbishop of Canterbury, Rowan Williams.
It began this process of turning a ragbag of settlers and pirates into a coalition that saw itself as one people whose destiny was in the hands of God.
The Essay.
Now that was a good king.
Weeknights on BBC Radio 3 at 10:45.
Well, now a second chance to hear last Monday's lunchtime concert from Wigmore Hall in London, introduced by Katie Derham.
Hello and welcome to London's Wigmore Hall for the solo debut recital of BBC New Generation artist, mezzo-soprano Jennifer Johnston. She is, it is roundly agreed, a rising star. Indeed, BBC Music magazine voted her exactly that, and the FT voted her the face to watch in opera. For her solo debut here, she's chosen a thoughtful and technically demanding collection of songs, which first and foremost she loves, but which also have a clear theme running through them. Every song deals with an aspect of love or loss. We're going to be hearing songs by Wolf, Britten and Mahler. First, Hugo Wolf's Mignon Lieder. Now, Wolf was an Austrian composer who lived in the heady days of Fin de Siècle Vienna and who, like his hero Schubert, was drawn to the work of Goethe. The songs we're going to hear are some of his best known, and they're inspired by Goethe's Wilhelm Meister. They tell the melodramatic and tragic tale of the young heroine Mignon. There are four songs. They're quite unusual, as each tells a different vignette in the story. They're not just poems. Some would say it was rather bold of Wolf to invite comparison with settings of the text by Beethoven, by Schumann and by Schubert, but many think that Wolf's intensity most accurately reflects the characters in Goethe's work. So first we're going to hear Heiß mich nicht, I'm not going to tell you my secret. Then Nur wer die Sehnsucht kennt, only those who know longing. Then So lasst mich scheinen, so let me appear. And then perhaps the best known of the four songs, the stunning piece about loss of home and past and family, Kennst du das Land? Do you know the land where lemons blossom? Well, here she is coming to the stage here at Wigmore Hall, Jennifer Johnston, with her friend and regular pianist, Joseph Middleton.
Heiß mich nicht, It's true.